I'd like to welcome everybody today to the panel discussion. I'm Russell Chesler, the panel moderator. I'm also a member of the Wealth Management Subcommittee of the Institute's Life Insurance and Wealth Practice Committee. One of our key objectives is to explore and expose the agency issues surrounding wealth management products' obsession with peer risk. So this session is part of that initiative. For those of you who've read the latest edition of the Actuaries magazine, you may have seen the article titled The Obsession with Peer Risk. That's also part of this initiative and will form part of the discussion today. The aim of today's session is not to come up with definitive answers, but really allow a forum for open discussion. So the way things will be running today, the session will be recorded and the highlights will be published in the Actuaries magazine. After my introduction, I'll be asking the panel a series of questions for about 40 to 50 minutes, leaving ample time for audience participation. And we would really appreciate that audience participation, as we want to make sure that as the subcommittee that we've actually covered all the issues. I should point out as well that we're very lucky today to have a number of non-institute members at today's session, and we've also got voter claim from Investor Weekly here as well. So just be careful what you say, otherwise you might get reported. And we will make sure that the session does conclude by 2 o'clock. It really is my strong view that investment managers and super funds are obsessed with peer risk. Investment managers hug benchmark indices to make sure that they do not fall to the bottom of performance tables. We also see default options in the major super funds all have amazingly similar asset allocations despite differing membership bases. To me, it seems like very much short-termism for commercial reasons has overtaken the need for long-term investing to match what are ultimately long-term liabilities. Even though there's lots of evidence of this obsession with peer risk, if you speak to most investment managers or super funds, they will say that peer risk is not a key driver of their investment strategy. Well, let's see what my full panel experts have to say today. I'd now like to introduce you to the panel. Firstly, we've got Chris Condon. Chris operates his own advisory firm, which leverages off his 3 decades investment management and asset consulting experience. Chris was previously MLC's chief investment officer, responsible for an investment team which managed $60 billion of manager-of-manager products. Sitting next to Chris, we've got Jeff Bresnahan. Jeff established Super Ratings in 2002 as an independent provider of information and opinion on Australian super funds. Jeff appears regularly on national television news and business programs, and his views are published in newspapers and magazines. Prior to this, Jeff co-founded the Australian Superannuation Group, which grew to be one of the largest independent consulting and administration houses in Australia. Next, we've got Alistair Barker. Alistair is an investment manager with Australian Super. He's responsible for portfolio and product construction, performance monitoring, and assessment of new investments. Prior to this, he was an investment director at Hastings Funds Management, responsible for developing portfolio strategy and investment research. And lastly on the end, we've got Dr. Jack Gray. Jack has a number of different roles. He's currently the adjunct professor at the Centre for Capital Market Dysfunctionality at the University of Technology, Sydney. He's a director of Brookvine, a specialist advisor on alternative assets, and an independent advisor to funds in Australia and overseas. He's regularly invited to speak at conferences on investing and publishes articles in both popular and professional magazines. He's also one of Australia's special representatives for the UN High Commission on Refugees. Please welcome the panel. So now to get into the questioning. So Jack, first question is for you. Accepting that there is... I need to use the mic. I've been recorded. Jack, accepting that there is this concept of herding among investment managers and super funds, how does this differ from other industries and businesses?
If you look at other industries, this is a hypothesis. If you look at mature industries around the world, they end up in a position of relatively stable equilibrium, particularly if they're scale-driven businesses, of a small number of very large businesses and a small number of smaller businesses. Think of the banks, car companies now, although it wasn't always like that, insurance companies. That seems to be the equilibrium position. That's what super funds are beginning to look like. The rules of that game, if you're in that game, is number one, you don't compete. The banks don't compete, we know that. So number one, don't compete, and especially don't compete on anything of material benefit to your customers like price. Unless, of course, you're forced to by regulation or you're forced to by some new entrant that might disturb you, like airlines were forced to by cheap airlines. So don't compete on anything of substance. Make sure that what you do compete on is the drivel, always on brand, on image, on the things that, and then convince customers that that's really important to them. So AMP's got a blue brochure and they have a swimmer who extols their virtues. Colonial has a red brochure and a runner who extols the virtues. And are they different? No, they're not. And that seems to be the way industries end up, for better or worse. It may or may not be optimal in any sense, but if you look at airlines and cars and insurance and banks, by and large it's like that. If that's the case, you've got to look at why that happens, but in superannuation it's even worse. So superannuation ends up that way, but even worse. And it's worse for three reasons. First of all the people doing, say, asset allocation or anything else use the same models and the same data and the same insights and the same advisors, and they've gone through the same degree and be taught by the same people and select themselves when they're in that position to do so. So you wouldn't expect anything different out of it, and indeed that's what you get. It's also a very comfortable industry with SCG. Why should we worry? Why do anything different? Doing anything different is, of course, risky, so you shouldn't bother with it. And so we've ended up with a bunch of funds that I think are horribly inefficient. We've created a system that maximises the number of agents, all of us here, and doesn't do a good job for the members. The solution, therefore, given that, is to get rid of most of them, force them to compete. Sweden is doing exactly that. Sweden had six funds that were meant to compete. After 10 years, they didn't. Why should they? They never will. And now they're going to have maybe two. So let's have two. The other alternative, and this you see this in industries, is in addition to the big ones, occasionally you see specialists, small specialists. Why are there no specialist superannuation funds? Well, mainly because, I'm afraid I disagree, the membership base is pretty common across all. The members are not that different. Everyone wants to feel different. They're not different. They're all the same. And that's what Canada has recognised with CPP and New Zealand has recognised. They're not. Now, there are some exceptions. So you could have a specialist fund that for the over 50s, which we used to have, that focuses just on pre- and post-retirement. There aren't any like that. You could have a small fund that is prepared to take very high risk, just as a high-risk differentiator. There's no one doing that. So we now have 200 or 300 funds. Let's get rid of them and have maybe two or three.
Chris, over your career, you would have researched a large number of investment managers. Can you tell us about your observations on this obsession with peer risk and how you identified managers which were benchmark huggers?
Yes, thanks. Yes, certainly on benchmark huggers, we're talking about specialist sector investors rather than asset allocation. And before I get onto the answer, I think that asset allocation, Jack was saying, is really where the main story is. But just on benchmark huggers, there's a big view that you put enough, every manager is a benchmark hugger, and I think it's true that a lot of them are. I think it's probably easier to identify the benchmark huggers than the others. Here's a profile of a manager, and I believe it is typical of a benchmark hugger. manager that has some very fine attributes, strong risk management, strong portfolio construction, some excellent people with strong finance degrees and numeric degrees, maybe a bunch of actuaries. They look very good on paper. It's much actually harder to find, I think, managers that don't obsess with the benchmark. One approach that I've used in the past, and it's backfired on me once or twice, is to give the impression that you believe that managing risk to the benchmark is as important as just about everybody else seems to think it is. And when you and you might even go as far as creating a chart to show what the tracking error of the manager has been and identify some sort of trend. It doesn't matter what it is. And then when you see the portfolio manager, you ask them, now, I've got this chart here. Can you please explain what's happening to your tracking error? Well, if the portfolio manager is on top of the issue and is able to give you a good, eloquent answer, then you should be worried. If the portfolio manager walks out on you for asking such a stupid question, then your job is to jump up quickly, tackle him at the door and say, I'm sorry, I was just testing you, and get back into it. But most of them don't do that because they're too polite. A lot of them fumble around. The better ones fumble around for an answer and say, look, sorry, I couldn't help you better understand this, and then you can let... then you know you maybe have a manager that's not a benchmark hugger. But I think the best approach is to ask the portfolio manager how he manages his own money. And when you start having that discussion, then you can start to tease out, well, why are you investing our portfolio in a particular way?
Thanks, Chris.
Jeff, your very popular surveys publish monthly and quarterly returns together with longer-term returns. What is your opinion? How does publishing those monthly, those really short-term monthly and quarterly returns affect the way in which managers invest investors' money at the end of the day?
Look, if we're talking about super funds there, which effectively we are, we don't really care what effect it has on them. I mean, if you go back as to why we published the surveys way back in 2003, it was because the only available surveys in the industry at the time were Mercer and Intech, who published PSC results. And a pooled super trust actually meant nothing to the end member because funds were using multiple PSCs to come out with a final number. There was tax implications. There was a whole series of other influences, which, you know, you could have had some of the best managers in the industry but still not performed well overall. So the whole intent of the survey was for consumers, not necessarily for super funds. But having said that, we're quite aware that super funds do take a lot more... or have a lot more awareness now of their peers in that process. But I wouldn't necessarily agree with the statement that everyone bunches around certain asset allocations, because certainly from the numbers we've got, there's double-digit differentiators between every asset class. You know, and in some cases, I think in just looking at my numbers before, but alternatives is 34% difference between the lowest and the highest. Cash is 15%. Fixed interest is 25% differential. So, look, there are a lot of funds that are willing to actually go outside the normal process. And if you look at the retail funds in particular, they are true to label, so they will have benchmarks and they really won't move away from them. Then a lot of the not-for-profit funds do actually benchmark hug, but then you've also got a number of funds that are willing to take fairly significant tilts. And in a lot of cases, those tilts have worked very, very well. So, you know, the MTAA discussion will come up today at some point, but if you look at someone like REST, REST's movement between asset classes can range up to 15%. And guess who's number one or two over 10 years? It's REST, because they've gone out and done those tilts. So I'm not necessarily going to agree that everyone is moving towards benchmark all the time. Yep.
Are we able to make comments?
Yeah.
I'm not able to take, I think, questions at the end. Leading on from that, Alistair's the investment manager from Australian Super. Can you tell us how you handle asset allocation at Australian Super?
Yep, sure. We have a fairly active approach to asset allocation, which really has been in place for quite a long time. You know, from the predecessor chair of the investment committee, who was Bernie Fraser, who had a view that economies shape markets. And we continue to hold that view, is that A long-term asset allocation is a great concept, but variations in returns are so significant over 10 to 15-year periods that you simply can't stick to it. So we certainly take an active view, and as Jeff mentioned, we have a sort of similar variation. I think our equity weights has varied, I think, from top to bottom around about 20%, there or thereabouts, so from as low as around about 42% in 2008-2009, up towards 62%, I think it was, in 2006. So, as most of you can probably figure out, those decisions were reasonably good in terms of the payoff for members. So, we certainly take an active view. But I think both Jack and Jeff have mentioned a really interesting point for me, which is there are some people out there who are being active, but you do have to ask, why are there a lot of people who are not? And, you know, if it has been successful, why are they sticking to a particular benchmark? So, and I think it really does come down to a few particular categories where, particularly in the retail space, there is appears to be a fairly significant, view that people go into a particular product and they're looking for that particular asset allocation. So there's a view that you don't want to vary it too much because you might not necessarily be meeting people's expectations. The second one, I think, is around the question of one size fits all. We have a view about why we have the default set the way we do for our fund. It's 80 or 85% of our members, and around about 80% of those people are below the age of 50. So we're targeting a particular asset allocation with a specific view about what to do for the bulk of our members. For those people who have a substantially older membership base, we could completely sympathise with why they might want to have a different asset allocation, but we just wonder why it hasn't necessarily happened. There are a couple of funds, and I should say there are a couple of funds who've taken a different, possibly brave approach about this. QSuper is certainly one, where they've looked to substantially de-risk their portfolio. A lot of that has to do with the fact that contribution rates for that fund average somewhere in the order of, say, 16 to 18%. Now, I know that if most of my members had 16 to 18% contribution rates and a consistent work history from a stable government, they get a comfortable retirement. The reality is most of our members don't have either of those two things working in their favour. So it's certainly something where we think there should be some core differentiation, but maybe not necessarily where the differences might not necessarily be as big as Jack alludes to in relation to, you know, one fund versus another where the membership bases may be particularly young. The third one observation I had on this was in relation to where ideas come from. We're blessed at our fund to have two asset consultants at our investment committee table. Not necessarily every fund has that arrangement, but in effect there are probably three or four, possibly a few more advisors out there in the Australian market who advise these funds. So you've got ideas coming from a reasonably narrow bunch of people, so it's hard to expect a great deal of differentiation when you have that. Now, investment committees may take a view that they don't want to necessarily apply the views of that asset consultant, but when those views are reasonably concentrated, it's fairly safe to assume that the resultant asset allocations are going to be fairly similar as a result.
Thanks for that answer. The next few questions I'm just going to throw out to the panel. If a number could be put on it in terms of return, how much is this short-termism and other agency issues costing Superfund and other investors?
Ron Bird and myself at UTS we're just in the process of writing up a piece on agency costs in superannuation. We estimate that there's about a 3% a year cost from agencies. 1% is because they do try to mimic and compete on returns, and competing on returns simply destroys returns. You compete on returns, you're pushed into momentum. Momentum pushes prices further away from fair value. They have to return and you lose. And we've got some models that the US Department of Commerce uses to show that the effect of competing is actually a 1% cost to the members. There's another 1% cost from the excessive number of funds all doing the same thing. It's an enormous cost. Have a look at the agency cost in Vision Super and Equip now. It's got nothing to do with rational decision making. Pure agency costs. And then there's another 1% from the inability to make decisions, which is just a form of herding. We think it's about that, and I'd be surprised if it's much less than that. We've just finished a survey of CIOs, CEOs and consultants, and just picking up the last comment, we surveyed 40 senior asset consultants. Of those 40, all of them had the same sort of background: actuarial, econometrics, maths, that was it. So why are we surprised they all think the same way and they all do exactly the same thing? We reproduce each other. And as Charlie Munger says, the most important thing in investment management is having different mental models, as Munger and Buffett and all the other great investors show. And we have one mental model and it's failing. So I think it's a substantial cost.
Okay. I agree that we have certainly a narrowness of thinking. I'm not convinced that the solution to that is to have the ultimate narrowness of thinking of one or two funds, which is the sort of proposal that you've made in the past, Jack. I am much more optimistic that this is actually an industry that does talk about this issue, and it's starting to talk about it more and more. And it's never going to be, it's always going to be messy, because that's what competition is. I would like to see it messier in terms of there being more variability, and I was heartened with some of the statistics that Jeff gave. I think the solution for this is not concentration.
We've actually got 56 registered under APRA, but they don't do anything. Essentially four. So is that bad or good?
The problem is in this market like this is that we don't have enough talent to run four big banks.
Absolutely.
The problem in this market is we don't have enough talent to run four big banks. That's why three of the four big banks are run by, is it three or four, run by foreigners?
So if we don't have enough talent for four banks, how about 300 supervisors?
Yeah.
Sort of kills the idea, doesn't it?
There's really only about, well, there's less than 100 commercial or competitive super funds around these days. And out of those, our view is we'll end up with 6 to 8 major super funds in Australia. And the rest will be niche players. And I think, Jack, you're probably slightly wrong. There are some really, really good niche players out there at the moment who know that that's the only way they can compete. There's a number of funds that are trying to be all things to all people. They won't survive past Superstream in 2014, so they will finally go. And it will look something like the banking sector, you know, with the major pillars, the credit unions and the building societies. It'll be no different to the super fund system. But one of the other things I wanted to say is we talk about all this peer pressure and asset allocation, those sort of things. This compulsory super is 20 years old this year, and yet we're still trying to mollycoddle the consumers to say, don't worry about it, we'll do everything for you, hence my super, which is just the worst thing that's ever happened. At what point are we going to say to consumers, you know what, it's up to you to tick that box. You know, you've got to tick a box in terms of your own investments, but when it comes to mortgages, you've got to find your own mortgage. But when it comes to super, we're trying to be, you know, this great moral position to say we'll do everything for you, and I think that is wrong.
First of all, let's never call them consumers. They're human beings and people. Calling them consumers dehumanises them. And it's also, you don't want people to think as consumers. If you want them to be long-term investors, they are the antithesis of consumers. They're people. But can people actually make these decisions? Should we leave back surgery open to people too? At what point do we say, and back surgery is probably easier to select a back surgeon, because past performance is a damn good indicator of future. You don't want a contrarian back surgeon. You really don't. But that... here we are asking people the cognitive and emotional load required to understand superannuation and investment and insurance and everything else, and the fast-changing nature of it is too much to ask people. Most people, I think, are very sensible by saying, I'm not interested. I think that's a very rational approach. Leave it to some others.
Well, why don't we just go... Why doesn't the government just run the whole damn thing? That should have happened in 1992. Sorry, if we want to go right back to that structure...
Well, not an independent body, not a government, an independent, like CPP. Like CPP in Canada, yeah. Like the Swedes are going to do.
Yep.
Yeah.
Can I make an observation on this? I think that if I take the analogy of the car industry, and most people, consumers if you like, aren't mechanics. And we have actually a very competitive car industry that makes cars. The cars that I was driving when I started to drive, I wouldn't put my son in these days, because they're just dreadful. And the cars these days are much, much better. Technology works and there's a lot of competition. And yet, if ASIC had its way, if ASIC was the regulator, the manual wouldn't fit into the glove box. It would fit in. It would have to go in the boot. You'd actually have to read it before you started. To know whether there were any brakes on it at all. And I suggest that the discussion here is somewhere in between these two positions. It is a regulator that is mandated and does take risk as a regulator and creates a private industry, for-profit, not-for-profit, I'm not worried about that, and enables private solutions to happen that are fit for purpose. And we don't have that now.
Can I just comment on the car industry? It's an interesting example because back when there was a reformist government, back in the dream time, with Keating and Hawke, one of the things that John Button, who was industry minister then, did is looked at the car industry. And the car industry was cosseted and had 57% tariffs, and he said this is wrong, and he was right, and he brought the tariffs down. But that wasn't all, because he knows that people aren't going to compete. Why would you compete unless you have to? Capitalists hate competition. Let's accept that. If you can get away with not competing, you will. You might at the margins, and that's all. And Button was smart enough to know that. And so he not only brought the tariffs down dramatically, but he also told them that you are going to get rid of all these absurd models. Now, it's a different industry, very high fixed costs and so on. And he gave them a number. He actually said, you're going to get down to this within 6 years. And that's what drove them to be competitive, but also to be cooperative. They actually cooperated. Honda, Toyota and General Motors cooperated on the development of a short engine, like drug companies in America are. And in Australia, in our survey of funds, the common comment was, when we asked them, do you ever cooperate with other funds, the answer was, we used to, and we used to get a lot of value out of it, and now with competition we don't. That's the effect of competition in this industry.
I just wanted to follow on Jack's comments about the car industry being cosseted. If you look at the environment in which many large superannuation funds operate, whereby they are designated as the default fund under industrial awards, that looks a bit like cosseting to me. And if you also take on board that many of the people who are involved in running those funds come from very similar backgrounds, which is loosely associated with the Labor, industrial or political Labor Party, where there's a strong tradition that you don't have disagreements in public, you sort everything out behind closed doors, and this is not a recipe for having very much diversity of view. It may be that individual funds like Australian Super are doing a great job in spite of those handicaps, but it would appear to me that those sorts of institutional influences are strong encouragements to funds competing in a superficial way, but not really competing, because they are largely producing similar returns at a portfolio level. It may differ in individual asset classes, and they've got very similar cost structures, very similar fee structures, and they are selling their services to people, whether we call them consumers or not, who by and large don't really want to be different. The majority of people in the population want to be like everyone else. There's a strong 80-odd percent of the population probably wants something the same as the person down the road. So it's not surprising that the providers, the fund managers, the superannuation trustees are responding to this environment.
Let's move on to maybe another question. This is really considering the industry super funds. Industry super funds are non-for-profit, so why is this obsession with peer risk? Why is there this competition if they're actually non-for-profit?
Well, it's a question we get asked a lot, particularly in our position as probably the largest public offer industry fund out there. I think the challenge we have is that our major competitors, to a large extent, are the major four financial services organisations that run for profit. And if we're of the view that we can offer the best products and services to our members, then if we don't in some form try to compete or at least talk to our members and create some awareness with them, then they may make some suboptimal choices, take the wrong advice, or thankfully a lot of the legislation around advice is actually sort of getting to the heart of the issue, which is people have to look after people's best interests. Now, up until that legislation was passed, we were probably of the view that the industry fund sector was really the only part of the financial services organisation apart from SMSFs who really did that. And SMSFs is reasonably obvious how that particular situation manifests itself, because people aren't happy and people aren't having their best interests looked after. To the question of why we compete, I'd agree that there probably has been over the course of the last 10 to 15 years more competition amongst the industry funds. I think if you look back 10 or 15 years ago, there were a number of initiatives set up across unlisted assets, administration, banking, where people were of a mind that cooperation was potentially the important thing to bring to bear scale and to bring to bear a consistency of purpose across various services for the members. And one would argue that those have been reasonably fruitful in terms of what they've done. But the question of competition around investment performance has been one which, to a large extent, has probably not been as big an issue for the people in our investment team as it is for the people in our marketing departments and so forth, because they're looking to go head-to-head with some of the financial services firms. And unfortunately, what we see as a result is we in effect have to be more like a retail offering in terms of how we compete and how we operate, which is a little unfortunate to certain extents.
Do any of the other panel members want to comment on that question?
The only thing, I think, look, this industry is still very immature. People retiring these days have only had less than half their working lives in the compulsory system, so it's immature from a people point of view. I get that right, Jack. Also from a fund development point of view, I mean, the governance side of things has increased markedly over the last 10 years, but it's still got a way to go. And our view is very much that the third, a third, a third trustee model is far superior to what there is at the moment, because I think, even the Vision and Equip blow-up on Friday has shown that there are some issues with current governance models. So, it's an industry that's still got a long way to go. It's professionally run, but we just think there's room for improvement on that, on the governance side of things.
So just to be clear, third, a third, a third is a third independence, and a third from the employer-employee side. Just the governance, I think, is right. If you look at the tone of how investment is made, it does come from at superannuation fund level and also at a retail fund level. It comes from the leadership of the fund, the trustees, or the senior management of the financial services firm, and that's really that can really create significant signals that you can take risk, and to me that's where we need to be focusing the attention to this issue.
Thanks, Chris.
If we look back to the 1980s, we would have seen that average portfolio turnover was only about 17%. So that means an investment manager only turned over their portfolio once every 6 or 7 years. That increased to 110% by 2005. We're now seeing increased push for disclosure and regulation, both by consumers and regulators. How is this further going to affect the way in which investment managers and super funds manage money?
That turnover in Bogle's data on US equity mutual funds, which is the best data there is, that's been going up almost linearly actually, over the last 60 years. So the average holding period in 1948 in different industry was about 5 years. That's how long a mutual fund held its stock for, and now it's about 6 months. That's how long it holds it for. But worse than that, the average consumer, and I use the word advisedly because mutual funds are sold like breakfast cereal in America, so that you do consume them, the exact antithesis of what you want. The average person holds a mutual fund for 2 years. So this is long-term investing as we now know it. And when you talk to managers about it and say, so why has the turnover gone up? You hear all sorts of variations of nonsense. The usual nonsense is, well, information flows more quickly. No, it doesn't. Drivel flows more quickly. The information doesn't flow any more quickly. The drivel in the AFR, you know, who needs 70 pages every day in the Australian financial industry when Europe and Britain has 30 pages once a week or something? It's just drivel. And we've got to learn how to not pay any attention to drivel, TV, all the rest of it. But that flows quickly and that influences people. But the key question to ask is, does it show in performance? And Bogle has this wonderful figure that looks at mutual funds, about 1,000 mutual funds, and shows, yeah, it does influence performance. The more you trade, the less you make. That's the one. There are very few constants in investment management, but there's one. The more you trade, the less you make. The more the brokers will make, the more the managers will make, the less you, the individual, will make. And that's so deep in us individually and institutionally that I don't see any clear way of stopping that. The number of reports on short-termism could fill volumes now.
I'd agree with those comments, but I guess I'm probably slightly more optimistic about whether the tide will turn on that. One particular thing that comes to mind for us is tax. I mean, we've got a very clear incentive to cut our trading back and better get our tax outcome under control. And we've done a certain amount of that over the last probably couple of years, and that's really started to show up in some benefits in some of the returns we're seeing. So I think in Australia we've got this natural incentive to get better at it, and you know, we've slashed the number of active managers, we've started using indexing where we don't think it'll add value, and we're focusing more on the tax position. So I think for us, as we sort of start to, you know, look at, you know, what we do ourselves and more of these issues around better optimising some of those outcomes, I'm hoping that we, in our fund in particular, will start to redress some of those issues. But I do share your concern for, I guess, the broader industry and consumers.
Yeah, if I could just say that I also agree, Jack, that a high turnover is rarely a good thing. You want to be keeping your turnover as low as possible. I don't make the leap, and I want to make this really clear, that means that you should be thinking about passive management. And you didn't say that, Jack. So I agree that to have a manager, say an equity manager, that is taking a view on a set of stocks based on how they believe those particular assets are going to go and over the next number of years is the sort of thing that I find very favourable.
And I would say that one of the strategies that was most interesting to us, we visited a overseas pension plan a year ago, and they had one equity portfolio, so just global equities, 70 stocks, internally managed, long-term buy and hold return. Wouldn't buy a stock unless it was going to produce a sustainable return over the next 10 years, minimum five-year hold period. When you think about running a portfolio like that, clearly you've got to be somewhat very benchmark unaware. But there are some people out there who are moving towards that, and they're saying, look, if I can't generate a decent real return out of any particular stock, then why is it in my members' best interest? So it certainly started to provoke some thought for us as to, you know, looking outside of the sort of traditional models of how these things are done. Because that strikes me as being a far better outcome than just indexing, which appears to be just a little bit of a compromise candidate in a way.
The John Kay, who's a professor at London Business School, LSE, was asked by the UK government to write yet another report on short-termism in the UK stock market. So this is number 13,000, which indicates that there is a deep psychological and institutional problem when everyone's aware of the problem and nothing changes. In fact, I've got comments from John Maynard Keynes in 1936 calling out about the obsession with short-termism, and Bogle has for 40 years and so on. John Kay's insights, one of them, stands out, and that is he says this industry is obsessed by process. So obsessed by process that, in fact, you actually win business and you maintain your job, not even whether the process produces a good outcome, but your ability to articulate the process. Now, who's at fault there? Well, certainly actuaries. There's no question of that. And CFAs and MBAs, because that's what they're taught. They're not educated. They're trained. And that's the thing we've got to change. There's a fund manager on the West Coast I know, very talented and terrific fund manager, who will not even look at anyone with an actuarial degree, a CFA or an MBA, will not even tolerate them into the office because he knows they've been narrowly trained. The training he can do on the job, he wants someone who's educated, who can think in different ways and who's got the right temperament. And the answer is you've got to have people with the right temperament, with courage. When I was a CIO at Sun Super, we had an investment that was doing very badly. It wasn't mine, so I didn't make the appointment, so there was no endowment effect. I wanted to keep it, and the board was very anxious. And the board said, if we keep going like this, we'll start losing members. And Don Luke, who was the CEO then, a man of courage and integrity, said, why should we care about that? Why do we care about that? So the members who feel dissatisfied will leave. If we are right about this investment strategy, and it turned out we were, and it comes good and rewards them more, those members who stayed will have done the job for them. So that's what we should care about. Why do we care when members leave? Because of the agency cost. Now that sort of courage is what we need, and there's just none of that.
I say amen, brother, to that. But that wasn't the question that you asked earlier, the question of this overtrading. I mean, I think Chris mentions ASIC, and I think, you know, if we had ASIC regulating the motor car industry, the windscreens would be blacked out because it would be dangerous for people to look out. And I think the particular example of that, I mean, if you want to really measure and constrain something, you've got to measure it. And the fact of the matter is that accounting standards currently do not report trading costs to the trustees, let alone to the members. I mean, that's an outrageous situation in the current environment. And ASIC's in charge of accounting standards, which is the issue. But it seems to me that if one really wants to move at these things carefully, it's not just tracking error you should be looking at. It's also it's the trading costs, it's the cost of trading, the market impact. I think it should be standard approach for trustees to ask for momentum impacts, because the momentum is one of the issues that is the negative thing. I mean, you've mentioned that's 1% cost. There's a lot of evidence that momentum trading was actually profitable for many years, not in the last little while, and certainly it would be of interest, I would have thought, to all managers, all trustees, to know to the extent to which their managers are momentum traders and the extent to which that momentum is actually adding or subtracting value. Because that's the question they really should be asked. Just finally, because I want to grab the microphone again later. I mean, I think the ultimate measure of actually are we doing a good job or not is whether we are actually allocating capital adequately in Australia. I mean, that's the ultimate question. And I would think that the results in the last 5 years are not bad. I mean, we put a couple of $50 billion into the banks to bail them out. probably a good call. And there's $100 billion gone into mining investments. I don't know to what extent it's come from super funds, but the Australian investment market has shown itself to be quite flexible. I mean, I think probably made half of that will be lost as a large hole in the ground, but nevertheless has been flexible and has done some useful things. So we shouldn't be too hard on the industry. Just on the regulator.
Thanks, Andrew.
The regulator, you know, you've got to, first of all, I think we choose the wrong people for regulators. The regulator should be, I think, like Cameron wanted to, be in the Reserve Bank. He wanted to put the FSA inside the Bank of England. I don't know if he still does. The point of that is that the Reserve Bank and the Bank of England have high standards and they employ very talented people. And I'm not sure the regulator, the way we see regulators, they don't do that. But it also means it's more independent. And it's not independent.
Also how they're mandated.
But if you think of regulators, there is one example of regulators doing a fantastic job, and that's the airline industry. I think the airline industry, as an example of our ability to engineer and create things and fly planes and the regulator's ability to make sure they're safe, is a phenomenal example of what the human being can do. And part of that is good regulation.
Just coming back to the original question, is the short-termism going to get worse because of increased disclosure and regulation and the fact that it has got worse and worse over the years?
Well, what you're doing is releasing a whole lot more information, which will lead to potentially more questions, more scrutiny. I'm not sure of a member who's going to want to look at our portfolio disclosure, which has 8,000 line items, and try and make sense of that. I'm just not sure of what member, apart from maybe you know, the odd sort of type A personality with a 170 IQ, is going to want to take the time to actually get an Excel spreadsheet up and try and understand what we're doing. So I'm not necessarily sure it helps at the member level. But what it will do is open up, you know, significantly more, I guess, ammunition, for better or for worse. We don't have a problem with being, with scrutiny. We just prefer it to be, you know, in a constructive manner. But I'm firmly of the view that I think that it will increase short-termism.
Just a quick one for Alistair. Don't go and work at uni, supermate, because that's what they do every day, professors. But look, short-termism is an issue. I don't think we've got people changing investment options on a regular basis because of information that's out in the general domain. The key thing is that we do provide sufficient information to them with which they can make an informed decision, and the advisors want that as well as people. So I think it's fine. And the other thing is, you know, the stuff that's in the media is not fund-specific. I mean, we've been very careful from day one never to put fund names to 1, 3, 6 month performance, because it does nothing. All we're doing is giving information saying this is what the industry is doing in totality, rather than saying, look, Australian Super's been great for 1 month. I mean, that's irrelevant information, and we've never done that intentionally. Others have from time to time, which is wrong, and the media shouldn't run with it, but we're very strong on saying we will not release short-term numbers at fund level all the way through.
Thanks for that, Jeff. What I'm going to do...
Can I just comment on the information? Danny Kahneman, if you read his latest book, Thinking Fast and Slow, shows quite without any doubt that the more information you give people, the more short-term they become. That's natural. It's almost built into us because it's our limbic brain, the brain that to do with flight and fright, that controls investment decision-making and almost all thinking initially. And that's the purpose. If you think of what is the purpose of data, you see the ASX went down 2 points. Or you look at what they laughingly call the news on TV, and gold went up 3 points. Who cares? Why would anyone care about that? It's dangerous stuff. Let's get rid of it. Let's have just a random number. And then people feel good. You know, today's number, seasonally adjusted, is up. No, feel good about it. Because that's all it is. We know it's noise. Everybody knows it's noise. It's drivel. And yet, what it does do, like all advertising, is designed to increase anxiety. You're not beautiful enough, you're not smart enough, you're not rich enough. That's all it does. Now, how do we learn to ignore that? It's very hard, as Danny Kahneman shows. It's really hard. You can. It requires a lot of self-control because it's not natural. But when you're a CIO of a fund, one thing you can do is not make short-term performance a key issue. Don't hide it from the trustees. Do what I guarantee works. Put it on the intranet. Show them how to press the buttons, and they will never look at it. And if you come in whenever you have a meeting, God, every month, for God's sake, but whenever you have those things, if you have monthly performance in front of you, that's what they'll look at. So don't hide it. You're not trying to be like the Soviets. You can't hide it. But just make it a little bit difficult for people. Nudge them a bit and give them the help. They'll never look at it. And that way you can get their minds off some of these things.
That really leads me on to my last question before I open for the audit, to allow the audience to ask questions. What practical things can boards and investment committees do to mitigate the strong focus on peer risk?
Well, I think Jack's just probably said the first major thing on that. The one thing that we certainly try and do is try and take a step back and not forget what your main end objective is. The inordinate amount of focus which is placed on short-term returns is there, and I agree it's very difficult to fight, but unless you're actually anchored in what you're doing over the longer term and focused on whether or not you're delivering to that, because all these numbers in the intervening period, they're just a means to an end. Yeah, they're noise, but they're a means to an end. So we just try and say, are we tracking towards our objectives? Not how are we going this month? Are we tracking towards our objectives? And if we're not, we just ask the question. And we just say, are we happy to hold it, or do we want to close a position down? It's a very simple question in that case, but it's a very difficult thing to fight. But unless you're really clear up front with trustees about saying, where are we going, what are our objectives, what's most important to us, you end up having the discussion about short-term performance.
Yeah, look, I think this does come down to leadership at the governance level. Now, that might be the chair, it might be the CIO, it might be the secretary. I mean, it'll vary according to personalities. Just recently, I've been advising a client who was really getting lost in the detail for their investment committee. And so the approach that we've been taking is to say, how does this committee deal with these things? And it is driven by the agenda and all the papers that come into it. And these papers can be very, very detailed. So I said, well, maybe the way to think about this is to have for each major investment area a standard set of things that you consider, maybe a table. What is the objective of this particular area? It might be the public equity market side, it might be the asset allocation side. What is the objective? What is the strategy? How potent are the decisions? Sorry, now the next question was what are your investment beliefs and how's it tied back to the organisation? And then the next thing is, how potent is this? Are the decisions that you make here for the fund as a whole? And some sort of simple numeric examples, you know, if you miss out on asset allocation when markets go down, it could have this effect on the growth fund or whatever. What's happened? What are you concerned? What's the investment, the CIO or the investment manager concerned about? And what are we going to do about it? And have it standardised like that, and have everything else relegated to the intranet. I do think that as a practical measure, taking control of the agenda and making sure that it is the right questions that are being asked rather than the focus on the trees, on the leaves. I'll just finish up with an expression that I heard recently, and I looked it up. Somebody in the 1960s, can't remember who it was, said the amount of time that a committee spends on something is inversely proportional to its complexity. And the example is the committee's got to decide on whether the safety mechanisms in the nuclear power plant that it owns are up to scratch, and what colour to paint the bike shed. They spend more time on the colour to paint the bike shed. And that is a well-known one. So,
Just following on from Alistair, because I think you hit it on the head, the, that from a trustee point of view, have they met their objectives is the key question. For that's for people and also for the trustees themselves. That's what they're setting out to do. Yeah. The reality is that objectives were set in 1993 as part of the SIS requirements and been basically set and forget for 20 years. And are they appropriate? And I think the GFC's proved that the objectives that were set back 19 years ago don't work. So it's quite interesting to look at. We did a review about 3 or 4 years ago of measuring funds against their actually stated objective. And out of 315 options, what was it? Sorry, out of 413 options, 312 weren't measurable. They didn't have sufficient information in that objective to actually measure it. And to give you a classic line, this is one of the objectives from the trustee in the PDS, to provide moderate to higher returns over the medium to long term through a diversified portfolio. What the hell does that mean? How do you measure it? Yeah, we've moderate to high returns over a diversified portfolio over the medium and long term. Not measurable. And I think that's part of the issue here, that you can't measure what the trustee is actually stating they're trying to do. What is it?
The downside of that is that many things are not measurable. In fact, the most important things in life and investments are not measurable. And it was Drucker who said if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. That's true, and what he had was the other side of it, that by measuring everything, you're missing out on the important things. And GDP is a classic example of that, of just measuring the wrong thing because you can measure it. The other thing is that objectives are fine, but they're not independent of the goal, of the paths. Life is path-dependent, as it is with investments. You can have one objective of CPI plus 3, but the way you get there is going to be absolutely critical. And the only way that can be managed is by having people with the right character and the right temperament. And that we don't look at because we can't measure it. We measure IQ. And as Buffett says, high IQ and investment success are not well correlated. And they're not. He then says, as long as you've got an IQ of over 25, if you've got the right temperament, you can do well. And he is spot on. It is the temperament that's important. I was once talking to a board when World Dubai was blowing up, and the board was obsessing about World Dubai, which was, what, one basis point, half a basis point? And I said that to them. I said, you're looking at the wrong thing, unless you believe there's some contagion happening, but that wasn't the level of the discussion. And one board trustee said, yeah, but when we go out and talk to members, they say, what's happening with World Dubai? And I said, well, that's where you've got to lead. That's where you have to show courage and say to the member, look, that's not the right thing to focus on. This is what the right thing to focus on. And that's the sort of leadership and courage that Buffett is 100% right on. Look at Hardy Industries and all the others. What was totally lacking was moral courage. And that's, I'm afraid, lacking here.
What I'll do now is I'll open for questions from the audience. Please state your name and company for recording purposes and wait for the mic.
Hello. Yeah. Craig Aspinall from CFA Institute. I wanted to ask a question about, I think, you know, one of the things we're focused on here is asset allocation, which is probably the wrong thing to be focusing on. And I think that's partly driven, as Chris sort of states, around what the regulator stated and what we have to disclose to members. And we have this sort of range of asset allocation models. When you look at what's happening in Europe, if you look at what's happening in the US, where they don't have the same level of regulation, they don't have the same competitiveness, and they don't have the same choice, they're much more focused on risk allocation and getting good risk outcomes and return outcomes, regardless of the instrument used and regardless of where the asset class lies. If we look closer to home, New Zealand Super is probably the best run example of this. So I'd like to ask the question, New Zealand Super model, if people don't know it, is that no one has an asset class specialty, that the investment team works on what are the risks in the portfolio and how do we implement it and what are the risk and return dynamics, which is the sort of thing the Future Fund are trying to get to. New Zealand Super's already done. So, Chris and others on the panel, to what degree does the greater level of specialisation asset class specialists within the teams, the superannuation funds, and ASIC's and APRA's reliance on asset allocation driving a lot of these problems?
Well, I think to a large extent. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, and in fact, red-faced enough to be part of the progress of change when the debate was should we have one balanced fund or several balanced funds. Now, at the time, that was back in the 80s, of course, at the time we were saying, well, in fact, balanced funds aren't very good because they just really weren't very good, a lot of them, and you should be looking at maybe hiring a bunch of sector specialists. If you get sector specialists, you get better outcomes. By the way, if you do that, you need to start to think as trustees as of doing your asset allocation, and we can help you with that. And so an industry was created that eventually forced the elimination of just about every form of holistic investing, holistic integrated investing, which is how I would describe what you said that the Future Fund is trying to do, out. It just wasn't possible because, in fact, there was no demand for that type of investing because you had to take control of the asset allocation. That was the most important thing, and it is probably the most important thing. The question is to whether the people that are taking control of asset allocation are fit for purpose, and I don't think that's always the case. And the regulators certainly aren't helping in this regard because they seem to have mindlessly assumed that an asset class actually means anything and require all sorts of disclosures around asset classes. And then the marketing departments, particularly in the retail area, but I'd say in the industry funds area as well, demand that you be able to tell the clients, your members, what the asset allocation is according to some historical concept of an asset class that has been developed years ago by these people that were trying to create a job for themselves. So it's and the regulators fell in that trap as well. And I think some things that Jack has said is quite right. Everybody's been trained the same way.
I think challenge on risk factors in my mind is you're trying to specify what the factors are when the reality is you probably don't know half of them as we sit in terms of what risk factors are going to be relevant in the next 5 to 10 years. So a lot of people try and deal with risk factors by modelling it, and the reality is that as much as a number of people in the room would be attracted to that as a concept, it's not very easy. And it's like weather forecasting. Whatever you come up with will be wrong. So it can certainly be helpful as a guide. And that's kind of the way we say, look, risk factors are another way of looking at the portfolio, like asset allocation, like the old growth versus defensive. I mean, they're just different ways of looking at the portfolio. And you never know. They might actually provide some useful insight at certain points in the time. But they each suffer from the same fundamental problem, which is you're grouping based on a historical belief or heuristic about how things perform.
There's no doubt that, as Chris said, the move from balance funds, the way they were run, were not particularly great. The asset allocation was really pissing about. We'll take 0.5% here and 0.5% there, and it did nothing. It was fundamentally flawed. But the spirit behind it of a holistic approach is lacking. And when the specialist move came in, there was no evidence that that would do better, and I suspect there's still no evidence. But my God, was it good for every agent. The managers loved it, the consultants loved it, the trustees loved it, everyone except the poor member loved it. And so it's dominated, and that's part of what's led to the massive agency issue we've got today, all that specialisation. So how do you control it? How do you manage it? That's the job, I think, of the CIO. Now, it's not easy. You've got all these specialists, and they all know their area better than you do. That's where the character comes in. I speak from experience at GMO, where I was co-head of asset allocation. We wanted to get rid of emerging country debt, and, of course, the guy in charge of emerging country debt had a million complicated reasons why this was the worst time to do it. And you're not that familiar with it, so you really need courage, and you need an overall holistic view, which is Buffett's point about education, not training. People who are narrowly trained will not have that view. You need a broad educational view. The one thing that I know I missed during the crisis was a lack of attention to what was going on Wall Street. I think I had in my head that those crooks over there, they, whatever they're doing, however they're screwing the world up, it doesn't affect us pure investment managers. And there was that sort of segregation that was clearly wrong. I had failed totally to see the deep connection between these things. And that's a failure. And that requires not looking at what today's returns are. It requires thinking broadly and reading outside your normal domain.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Myron Mahalingam from MLC. I want to make an observation here, particularly directed at Alistair, but interested in the panel comments. In terms of, there's one risk which we haven't quite talked about, which is what I call career risk. If I take my mother to a financial planner, the right discussion to have is, congratulations, Mrs. Mahalingam, last year you had enough money to live to 100, now you got enough money to live to 102. What anybody else did, the other funds did, is totally irrelevant in my opinion. So if, when you're managing a portfolio and if you generate, say, 10%, which to me is a very good return and should be adequate to meet your client's objectives, but everyone else is doing 20%, and if you do that for 3 successive years, then I would suggest that the fund may survive, but you may not necessarily survive and have that job in 3 years' time. So in a way, I'd just like to invite comments in terms of doing the right thing. You can go back to what the objectives of the fund are, but if everybody else is doing so much better than you, then that is going to introduce this level of career risk that naturally means you regress. I use the word regress, not progress. Regress back to what everybody else is doing.
I'll have a go and then you can correct me. look, it's a very, very difficult thing to fight. That's the reality. When I spoke a bit before about objectives, I think that, to my mind, is the most critical thing, is that if we're delivering to our objectives, then we should take more comfort than that, in that than in other situations. In 2008, we got significant grief from our membership base over it was about a minus 13% return. In 2009, we got significant grief from our marketing department because we underperformed our peers by 0.5%. And we delivered a 10.2% return or something like that. So I think the organisational issues can be a little all-pervasive for some organisations, and it's certainly something we're trying to be conscious of. But certainly the members certainly don't feel underperforming peers anywhere near as much as they do a negative return. That's the reality, and that's the reality we should all be living in. Look, it's one we definitely have our issues dealing with, and I think the other point I'd make is that before I joined Australian Super, I spent a fair bit of time on the other side of the fence. And I think the issues are all pervasive in a lot of senses in some fund managers. And Chris might have some views either supporting or to the contrary on that. But when the firm's ongoing viability is subject to termination at a moment's notice, particularly in equities or in some other asset classes, then career risk is an immediate threat. And that's a real issue, and I think the agency problems that creates are big. So I think there is certainly a lower order issue in super funds, but certainly not something that is non-existent.
I'm afraid it comes down again to courage, moral courage, and knowing what you're there for. I speak with from GMO's experience leading into the tech bubble. The area I was in charge of, we lost 2/3 of our business, because we thought the bubble was ridiculous and kept out of it and kept explaining to people why, and they, of course, called us idiots, and after a while you think yourself as an idiot. You're an idiot, and it takes leadership and courage. It took Jeremy Grantham. I was very close to him, and the personal courage that took from him to stay against it, being called an idiot internally as well as externally, was enormous. And not many people would have done that. They would have caved in and lost the whole lot. We were prepared to lose everything. We actually went to the board and said, if this goes on for another year, we can lose the business. And the board said, is it the right thing to do? And we said, yeah, and they said, okay. So Tweedy Brown is a bit like that. There are some other managers like that. But it's about courage. It's about courage and taking a moral stance. And unless we're, you know, the only time principles are tested is when they throw bombs at you. When they threw bombs at us, America failed, we failed, Britain failed, France failed. We lost all principles. We locked people up, we tortured them. All the supposed sacred principles went out the water. When you're underperforming dramatically, it's the only time you're going to be tested. And most of us fail those tests. But that's what it's about. If you can find a manager who's got that sort of courage, who gives money back, as I know Tweedy Brown does, and as I know GMO has, when they tell you, get out of our funds, you find them and hang on to them. They're valuable. Because there are some around, not many.
Yes, I think the... I agree with that. But the... One of the problems with what you said, Myron, is that how do you know whether your mother is actually getting good advice, the best advice? So it's and often it is okay to be satisfying, but it's generally not. Now, I would suggest that the concept of benchmarking is something in its original concept. Is something that we shouldn't throw out. But there's years ago I used to define a benchmark to be one of the characteristics of a good benchmark is that it's replicable. I now believe that is not true. You actually don't want a replicable benchmark. What you want, because if you have a replicable benchmark, then people just try to replicate it, which is the problem we're talking about. What you want, I think, and what you are benchmarking should be thought about. So, for instance, in that particular the case of your mother's advisor, let's benchmark them not on whether they got 10% was as good as 20% somebody else got, but rather on whether they were making sound decisions using good investment. I mean, all the hard. All the soft things that are hard to measure, let's start benchmarking on that. Benchmark certainly on whether they're achieving your mother's retirement outcomes, and move away from some of the rate of return benchmarking. I know that rate of return, for example, should we actually be measuring rates of return, time weighted rates of return, or should we be measuring something else? Say a halfway house might be money weighted rates of return for individuals, or even what retirement income are you? Is this buying?
Thanks. I think we've got a question.
I just had a James Purvis from Purvis Barr and Associates. I just had a practical question for the panel. I think it was Chris who identified that there's a relatively small number of people who have critical inputs on the decisions, particularly people like the investment committee. And my question is, what is the optimum size for an investment committee in terms of numbers of people? And what sort of people should be on it? Should it necessarily, for example, include members of the trustee board?
Okay, just I think in my experience that 5 to 6 people that are able to get in a room and have enough confidence in the respect that they have for each other as individuals to have robust and fierce conversations sounds about right. When I set up my team a few years ago to really test out investment decisions, it was sort of like an investment committee, we had 5. And when somebody else came in one or two more people came in, that dynamic really did change. So for me, it's about five or six. Should it be members of the trustee board? Well, I think that probably depends on the member of the trustee board. I won't answer that one directly, but here is the sort of training that I think people on an investment, a governance committee of a fund should have. So these are not the investment decision makers. Well, they ultimately make decision. They make the decisions, but it's where there is a consultant or an investment team feeding up definite recommendations. So they've got to ultimately make the decision. My view is that so this is not like my old investment team. This is an investment committee. Those people should do everything they can and be trained in such a way that makes them never allow the investment professionals to suck them into their world. I think, for instance, trustee training for investment committees should not involve this is what a derivative is and this is what an equity is and this is what a CDO is and this sort of thing, but should be things like statistical inference, psychology, logic, economic history, and there's a bunch of others, and require the investment professionals and do not let the investment professionals suck you into their world, require you to converse on your world, so that discussions such as the one that Jack said he just missed can happen. I don't know if I entirely answer that question, but
I agree. I agree with Chris. I think five, six, something like that, is a good number. Most boards, by the way, are far too large. But when you talk to them, I was with a board recently of 16, and we know it's too large. But this is a sensational board. Apparently, every board in the country is sensational, and we've got to do something about that. It's insane. But five or six, and I agree with him. You don't want the professionals running that board. I personally don't want technocrats running those sorts of decisions. Kennedy, for instance, when the Cuban Missile Crisis was on, he did a couple of things that were really interesting. He had a committee, a group of people sitting around. One of the things he did, he was told by Charles de Gaulle, and de Gaulle said, whenever you're talking to the military, make sure they're not in uniform. Very, very good advice. It strips them bare of all the, you know, the fruit salad and all the rest of the high hats like Hitler used to wear, and it takes that out of it. And he did that. And then they're just like you and me. Now, investment professionals, we don't necessarily wear uniforms, but that's the way you've got to do it, is to handle that. And then the other thing he did was he recognized that he, Kennedy, was the center of attention. And you see that in committees. One person is running it. Jeremy Grantham was like that. And it was almost impossible to not discuss something that didn't end up focusing on him. He was just a very powerful individual. What Kennedy did is he removed himself. He said, you guys work it out. You guys show me the options and discuss them, and then I'm the decider, and I'll make the decision. Now, so there are techniques you've got to use, but I agree with Chris. You don't want the investment professionals making those decisions, but you don't want them not there either. And the others have to have the right character and the right temperament. They can't just be ordinary people. They've got to have that temperance, not IQ. It's a different sort of character.
Mike Barker. A lot of the focus has been on asset allocation. Now, to me, there are two aspects, strategic and tactical. As far as strategic asset allocation is concerned, I think most large funds are offering members a choice of either more aggressive or more defensive funds. There is choice. The fact that so many members go into the default fund is actually short-termism on the part of the members. It's not... You can't really blame the managers for that. And why members are so short-term, I think the answer to that is an education. But I'm not really focusing on that. I want to focus on tactical asset allocation. I've been in the industry for a very long time, and I've seen attitudes to tactical asset allocation all over the place. Certainly 10 years ago, there was almost unanimous view that tactical asset allocation didn't work. I think there are three views one is entitled to have. One is that it doesn't work. The second one is that it doesn't work and I'm going to go for it. And the third one is that it does work, but I don't do it because of business risk. Now, what I'd like to ask the panel is that which of those three is more important in the current environment, and is there anything we ought to be doing about that?
I'll start with what I believe, and it's the GMO view. I don't know what tactical means. At GMO, when we did asset allocation, we might have made two or three decisions a year, other than sort of cash flow decisions. There's not enough information to make do anymore. If tactical means pissing about, which is what all the consultants are now doing, having then said that you can't do it, now they're all doing it, of course, that's not going to work. We know that. A few hedge funds can do it, that's true, and there are a few managers who can do it reasonably well. It is a rare skill for all the reasons I said. You need to have a very broad view, a holistic view. You've got to understand a fair bit of detail, but not too much, and you've got to have the right character. But as for tactical and just making little moves, all that it's going to do is churn the portfolio and take things away. So I think I agree with you, whichever number that was. Don't even try it.
I tend to agree. We tend to follow a view where we're not strategic, we're not tactical, strategical, who knows what it's called. But basically what we do is we look at things beyond what the market's looking at in the next sort of, you know, week or month or whatever it is. The one thing I've sort of noticed is that people talk about it's more volatile these days. The reality is that you've just got hundreds of thousands of people trying to guess where on earth things are going to get end up. The reality is that if Argentina defaults, it'll default. It did it 100 years ago, it did it 5 or 10 years ago, and it will probably do it at some point in the next 20 or 30 years again, based on recent history. Now, those events will keep happening, but all we've got now is a heap of people guessing whether or not they're going to happen. And that's what Europe is. It's a guessing game. So we don't tend to say that it's a sustainable proposition to be having a bet against whether or not these things are going to do and sort of play in the information flow. Because the reality is there's someone who's going to be looking at more information flow and have more people, more computers, more equipment. You're never going to necessarily be ahead of the curve. So we tend to say, look, let's be pragmatic about it. Let's focus on a few things that we can sensibly take a view on and look at them over a time frame that we think is reasonable to realise return on them. So I think that's largely consistent with what Jack's saying, but in terms of what we call it, we don't really have a name for it. We call it our asset allocation.
Look, the big issue is business risk, which is what you raised, and I'd say the majority of funds do see business risk as a key issue and work towards their peers. When you look at the outliers, like MTAA, which I raised before, did something completely different in this industry back in, what was it, 1999, roughly it started, with the exposure to alternatives. Was it wrong what they did? I'd argue not, absolutely. And in fact, their performance is still second quartile to this day, so it's not as if they're bottom quartile. It's just, you know, so they are ridiculed in the industry and have been for the last 5 years for something that they didn't and stuck to their guns. And so some of the questions that came up before, it's the governance strengths or strength of the boards to stick with decisions that they've made. And again, I raise REST because if anyone, what do you call it, Stractical, if anyone does that pretty well, I think REST has done it. They did it back in the tech bubble of 2001-2, and they underperformed for about 18 months, 24 months, and copped it from various sectors. In the end, they were proved right, and they were underweight again at the beginning of the GFC. So they've got more of their calls right than wrong. But the thing is, everyone does get ostracised if they move outside that bubble. So where's the encouragement for funds to actually take some risk?
Okay, we've just got the last question over there, and then we'll close off.
Thanks. Janice and Gupta from Aon Hewitt. A simple question for Jeff. I'm curious about the composition of your subscriber base. In other words, is it mostly funds themselves that are subscribing to super ratings or others? And the reason I ask that is because I'm curious as to what degree the peer risk and career risk anxieties and fears that are being expressed are within the industry, fund managers, trustees, consultants scaring each other about peer risk, and to what degree the actual members actually care.
Yeah, it looks a good point, Jess. Our survey, I think, asked about 85% of every fund in Australia, so it is widely subscribed at fund level. I think a lot of these discussions, which have been going on for 5 or 6 years on a whole raft of issues, including performance tables, including definitions of growth, defensive assets, whole things like that which have never been settled, are intra-industry discussions. I really don't think it actually affects the consumer. So everyone yells at, you know, they can yell at us because we've got tables in the paper and, oh, you'll affect us, and it doesn't. You know, there's no evidence that people are swapping funds because of performance, with the single exception that I will say there will always be performance chasers. In the same way that there are funds that chase investment managers, there are individuals that chase last year's winner. And again, I'll use M2 as an example. They did have outflows in 08, 09, 10, and they were the million-dollar-plus outflows where punters thought they could be better than everyone else, better than advisors, better than all the other information, and jumped into MTAA after they sat at the top of the performance tables for years and then jumped out. So it's the old worldwide studies that have been done, in at the top, out at the bottom. You cannot, you know, stop that happening. But in terms of the overall big picture, I think we spend too much time talking intra-industry about issues that don't really affect people.
I agree. There's no... I've never seen evidence that people actually do leave funds. There's massive inertia. I think that's very sensible. I think it's very sensible that members don't open their account statements and don't bother with them. I think they're very showing real intelligence in doing that. And it's true. I don't... My son doesn't open it. I think he's doing the right thing. So there isn't evidence of that, but the fear there is there, and the fear is there for a very deep psychological reason, I think, and that is we're very status-conscious animals. The Whitehall study shows that. Look it up on Google, just how conscious we are of not being at the bottom and being with our peers. And Klingenberger, Joe Klingenberger, a professor at MIT, put it better than anyone else. There's nothing that so upsets our equanimity and good judgment as to see a friend get rich.
I'll leave you with those words. I promised we'd get you out by 2 o'clock, so all that remains is for me to thank the panel, Chris, Jeff, Alistair and Jack. Thanks very much for your very insightful and valuable comments, as well as taking the time to participate. Thank you for the audience for attending today, and that concludes the session.